Testcube is a test orchestration execution framework for Kubernetes.
So Kraken is a chaos and resiliency tool. It's pretty new to the CNCF.
In a few words, logging operator helps you automate the local action in Kubernetes.
Scarf is a platform for usage analytics for open source software.
When it comes to Kubeflow, it's an open source project, part of CNCF. That's why we are at KubeCon.
You are listening to the KubeList podcast, a show interviewing project maintainers for open source projects with a focus on CNCF sandbox, incubating, and graduated projects. Hi, I'm Mark Campbell. Together with Benji DeGroot, we publish the KubeList newsletter dedicated to Kubernetes and the CNCF ecosystem. I'm the founder and CTO at Replicated, where we enable software vendors such as HashiCorp, Puppet, Harness, and many others to operationalize and scale the distribution of their modern on-prem software. Check us out at replicated.com. Benji is the co-founder and CEO at Shipyard, where they enable teams of all sizes to build, test, and deploy faster and more reliably via their ephemeral environment management platform. Get started with ephemeral environments at shipyard.build. The KubeList podcast is brought to you by Heavybit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. For more information, visit heavybit.com. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or you would like to suggest a project, find us on Twitter at readkubelist. Finally, sign up for the KubeList newsletter and read previous issues at kubelist.com.
So Benji and I just spent the week at KubeCon in Salt Lake City. It was really fun and a busy few days, but we brought our microphones and managed to get some of the CNCF projects and a few other companies that have really cool open source projects sitting down and talk to them. We got a bunch of great updates and learned about some projects we hadn't really heard of yet.
Yeah, it was great. I had a really nice time. My one critique is I wish it was like 2 weeks later because they got a bunch of snow and I would have loved to have an excuse to go up to the mountains. But it was a really good time. It was really well organized, I would say. They were really checking tickets too. This is the first year that they checked my badge at everything. It was just really well organized. Unfortunately, the food was, I don't know how it's always that way, but the food is the food at KubeCon. There was a great cafe across the street. I'm forgetting the name of it, but I really enjoyed that cafe. They did a great job. I ate there most mornings and afternoons. For me, I think one of the highlights was Scott and Kelsey. So Scott from Docker and Kelsey Hightower sat down. I think it was the first day, and they did a platform at like the platform con thing. And they just talked about the history of Docker and kind of the ecosystem. And that was really insightful, I think. Some gems in there. Speaking of that, I ran and spent some quality time with Solomon. He's a fixture at KubeCon. Got some crazy more demos from the Dagger folks. Maybe we'll do an update with him in 2025. But Dagger is always really cool. Spent some time at the Replicated booth. I really like the keychain this year that you guys did, Mark. It was very subtle.
It was the Wasatch Mountains, yeah.
Yes, it was the mountains. It was a lovely keychain. There was some good swag there. What was my best swag? Oh, I will say this. Special call out to Microsoft. They had a fidget spinner with like the little dots that you push in and out. And I gave that to my nephew. And it's like apparently his favorite toy he's ever had. But I mean, overall, I had a really nice time. I would say that, you know, there were some friends that were missing, but it does feel like KubeCon's back. It feels like all the people that I want to see are there. Yeah, what did you think, Mark?
Yeah, it was really good. I think, you know, in a lot of the time that we spent, you know, with microphones and kind of going around, we were in the little CNCF project pavilion talking to some sandbox incubating and graduated projects. The ones that we have on this episode aren't projects that we've actually had a full episode on before. Some of them we probably should dive into and like spend some time and have bigger conversations. We also did catch up with some of the graduated projects like Helm, Argo, and planning to get some time on the calendar here really soon and actually talk about some of the work that's happening, because there was too much going on in some of those to have a quick 10-minute conversation on the show floor for a catch up.
Yeah, no, I think that we planned out some exciting episodes for 2025, made some good connections, and excited to get some more people on. If I had to say my highlight, I mean, honestly, the highlight is walking around the floor with Mark and, you know, shooting the stuff, signing up for giveaways that I never win. Mark, have you ever won any of those? You don't even sign up. It's just me, right? Mark doesn't have that disappointment that I do. Oh, the cookies. There were fresh cookies.
Portworx.
Portworx is giving out fresh cookies. So special call out to them, because I definitely gained about 10 pounds from those cookies. Yeah, I mean, I think that the interviews will speak for themselves, I definitely learned a good amount. Some of these projects were really cool. I really like Kraken. That one was really cool. I mean, Buildpacks, Kairos, all of them were great. And I definitely learned about a lot of them. So I'm excited to share this episode and get some feedback on stuff. I will say this, for our legions of fans, our legions and legions of fans, feel free to reach out if you have any projects that you want us to talk to in London. Mark's going to be there. I think I'm going to be there. Mark's definitely going to be there. It's a very free flow type of thing when we go to KubeCon, where we just go around and we talk to all kinds of different teams and even companies. So if there's anyone you think we should talk to or anything we should explore or dig into for 2025, please feel free to reach out.
Yeah, and I think on this one, this episode here, we have about 7 different projects that we talked to, and actually 5 of them are CNCF projects, if I'm not mistaken, and a couple are just, they're companies. So they have, it's open source, like, or at least open core, some variation of open source. And then they're building a commercial entity around it. But like, they're still really cool to talk to and understand like how you can use them and how they're contributing back to open source. So these 7 here, we're just going to string them together. They're all about 10 minutes or so long each. So this will be one episode. And like Benji said, we're looking forward to seeing everyone at the beginning of April in London.
Yeah, excited. Oh, by the way, Mark, I think that was the official first time a podcast did not talk about AI. In 2024. So I just had to drop that in there. Just say the word.
Oh, now we did.
Now I just wanted to say AI for everyone, just so everyone thinks, just to prove that it is 2024 that we went to KubeCon. But no, this was about DevOps. This was about SRE and platform.
And Benji, do you want to talk about eBPF for a minute too?
eBPFs are still hot, sort of. And KubeCuddl, obviously. All right, guys, have a great holiday season and look forward to catching you all in 2025. Cool. Sitting here with
Ole Lensmar
from TestCube.
Yes.
And tell, what is TestCube?
TestCube is a test orchestration execution framework for Kubernetes. So TestCube takes all the tests that you have today, your functional tests, your load tests, your unit tests, your acceptance tests, and runs them inside your Kubernetes clusters. And then it integrates with your CI/CD tools, so you could trigger those tests from CI, on a schedule, from Kubernetes events, from Argo CD, et cetera.
So what would be the advantage of running them in my Kubernetes cluster versus like letting a GitHub Action Runner actually run all the tests?
So there's a couple aspects of that. So the advantage of running them in your cluster could be security related. You don't have to open up your cluster for a testing tool running outside your cluster. You might want to run tests inside your cluster. You might want to run infrastructure tests, that kind of test low-level infrastructure provisioning, make sure your GPUs or whatever else are available. So that could be one advantage. The bigger advantage we see in our with our customers is that they use multiple CI/CD tools. So they use GitHub Actions, they have a legacy Jenkins, and then maybe they're going to Argo CD and GitOps. And today they have to manage the scripting and for the execution of their tests in all of those different CI/CD tools. And it just adds a lot of overhead to their ops team to do that.
So the way that I would do it is if I was using GitHub Actions or CircleCI, whatever the CI tool is, that's just an orchestration, but the actual logic to execute the tests I'm writing in TestCube.
Exactly. So we've built our own kind of workflow engine that's purpose-built for test execution that would then run your tests inside your clusters. And those test execution definitions are stored as CRDs in your cluster. So you can use GitOps approaches to sync them from your Git repo, et cetera. And then, but to your point, you trigger those then from your CI/CD pipelines, and we have integrations with all the big CI/CD tools, and there's a CLI and all that. The next big advantage then is that since all your tests are being run from one place, you have one place to troubleshoot your failed tests, to get reports over time for your test executions, to look at artifacts generated by your tests. And this is where we've kind of purpose-built functionality to aggregate all the data that we collect. So instead of your QA team having to go to Jenkins or to GitHub Actions or wherever else to look at logs or try to find the artifacts or whatever else they do, they can just go to the TestCube dashboard and they have everything in one place. And then, of course, we do test reporting, and which none of the CI/CD tools really do over time, right? They're very point. They give you the JUnit report for a specific test, but they won't show you, like, I want to see pass-fail ratios for all my tests for this team or for that component, et cetera, in one place. So we're basically replacing test execution in your CI/CD. We're not replacing CI/CD. We love CI/CD, and we want you to continue using Jenkins, GitHub Actions, Argo. But we think there's a big advantage of moving the execution of your tests into TestCube, which will then run them inside your clusters.
Right, and there's probably, like, a potential money savings, too, if I'm not paying for some massive GitHub action instance or CircleCI, whatever. So now this is an open source project, is that correct?
So there's an open source, the engine that runs our tests is open source, and then we have a control plane on top of that if you want to manage multiple engines, which is commercial. And that control plane can either be run in the cloud in our SaaS offering, or you can host it yourself in your on-prem.
But if I just had like one cluster that I wanted to run, I could just use the open source.
You can just use the open source. It won't have the nice dashboard, but it has a CLI and a REST API, and there's plenty of examples on our website how to use that.
Super cool. What is your website?
Testcube.io.
Okay, cool. And you're not CNCF right now.
So we are a member of the CNCF. The Testcube is on the CNCF landscape under testing, but we have not donated the Sound Sandbox project.
As of yet, yes.
As of yet, exactly.
And then what license is it?
It's an MIT licensed product.
Super cool. What's the next 6 months to a year? Like, what's the quick roadmap in 30 seconds? Anything big coming out?
A couple of things. We're getting a lot of adoption in big enterprise customers who have the problems I mentioned earlier, multiple CI/CD systems, very kind of fragmented infrastructure for running tests, and they need one place for their QA teams to look at, you know, get an overview of what tests are we running, what the results, et cetera. So a lot of functionality in that direction, integrating with test management tools, with defect tracking, you know, Jira, that kind of stuff. We're also looking, like everyone else, leveraging AI. In our case, it's about helping you troubleshoot failed tests. So TestCube is in a unique position to collect logs and metrics and any kind of metadata from your system under tests, right? So not just from the testing tool, but also from the microservices you might be testing, because TestCube knows when your test is running.
Yeah, so it seems to me that the big advantage of TestCube is that, especially for like end-to-end tests and from a security perspective, I can run against, like, basically behind pretty secure walls. I can test whatever I want. So that's a big advantage. There's a cost savings advantage. So, like, you're not doing unit tests, probably. Maybe you are, but it is more of a functional integration end-to-end test type thing.
Sure.
And so you kind of alleviate a lot of the overhead of getting to these specific environments or orchestrating these environments in the particular CI,
And then really make it easier to troubleshoot and report on your tests, because we have all the results in one place, right? So, but just going back to the unit test, a lot of people use unit testing frameworks to do integration tests or end-to-end tests. So PyTests or JUnit, we see a lot where people use that as a framework for doing like integration tests. So we run those tests as well, of course.
I want to talk a little bit more about troubleshooting tests, and maybe like this is actually worth like a whole deeper episode on the podcast at some point. But like a problem I've been dealing with a lot recently is troubleshooting like a failed test running in a GitHub action. I got to think like the architecture that you have where the test is running in a Kubernetes cluster I have gives me more ability to leave artifacts behind that I can like go poke at, debug, like take manual steps.
So exactly. So we can automatically today what happens under the hood is that our engine creates a Kubernetes job, which then runs the pods that run the actual tests. So we, of course, collect all the logs and everything from there. You can also then set up our workflows to aggregate logs from your system under test, right? Because even if you see that your API test failed, you might not know which of my microservices actually was the source of that failure. And then you're going to start digging through the logs of each of those to find a stack trace or something like that. And TestCube can once again aggregate all of that and put it into one view for the developer or a QA person that has to figure out why the test failed.
And it sounds like that's the real value, right? Because GitHub has like, so I know there's a lot of different CI providers out there, and that's a lot of value, which you're talking about. But GitHub has an actions controller that lets me run that in my own Kubernetes infrastructure. But I don't get that, like, any of the additional troubleshooting steps that you just actually mentioned. It's just where the test runs. TestCube isn't just that. TestCube is that plus the ability to debug, the ability to troubleshoot.
Exactly. So it's really a purpose built for testing, right? So you could, at a higher level, you could say, sure, GitHub Actions is a workflow engine, and so is Tecton, and so is Argo Workflows, but they're not purpose built for testing. They're generic and they're great at what they do. But we've really tried to focus on the jobs to be done and the value adds for testing or testers, right? And the workflows that they have to go, the jobs that they have to do.
I think that's great. I'm going to check you out a bunch. And like Mark said, maybe we're going to have to do a deeper episode on this one.
I'd love that.
Thanks for the time, Ollie.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Cool. We're here with Sandor Guba from OxoFlow. But we're here to talk about the logging operator. Sandor, tell us about the logging operator. What is it?
Yeah, so in a few words, logging operator helps you automate the local action on Kubernetes. So instead of manually configure the daemons as stateful sets to grab the logs from the different nodes, from the different pods, it uses custom resources, and it very much simplifies how you collect logs.
So I just deploy this as an agent into the cluster, and how do I identify what logs and how does that work?
So it's an operator,
okay,
and there are different custom resources, and you can define in the custom resources that which logs you want to collect and where you want to transport them. So for example, you decide I want the logs from the pods that have labels F Nginx, then it will grab all the Nginx logs and transport it for Loki, Elasticsearch, whatever you configure in the destination.
Does it do anything with the logs in the middle, or does it just grab them and stream them over?
It can. So you can do transformation in these log flows. So we call it flows. And the good thing is that because you know which logs you grabbed, you can apply. It's an Nginx log, I will apply Nginx transformation. So it will be much easier to decide the soup of logs that's coming from Kubernetes.
Okay, and what types of transformations do you see people out there using?
So logging operator uses FluentBit and FluentD under the hood, so whatever it supports. And there is a new operator called Telemetry Controller, which uses OpenTelemetry under the hood. And whatever Telemetry Controller collector able to do with logs, Telemetry Controller can do it as well.
And tell us about the beginning of the project. What company created this?
So back in the day, I was a co-founder of Bonsai Cloud. We started the project there. And like over 2 years ago, I founded a new company called Axoflow, and we're continuing the open source project there as well.
All right. And it's in logging operator right now is a sandbox project?
Yes, it's a CNCF sandbox project. And we started the telemetry controller under the logging operator as well. So we want to, at the point when the feature parity we hit, change it to telemetry controller.
When did it become a sandbox project?
1.5 years ago.
Oh, well, okay. Have you thought about the roadmap out of sandbox and into incubating?
That's why we started actually Telemetry Controller, because there was a lot of requests that we just couldn't fit in the logging operator architecture. So we sit back and started to schedule this one, and we have a proper roadmap supporting multiple logging architectures, and after then going for metrics traces. So we plan Telemetry Controller to be the ultimate operator for the observability signals.
And do you have a timeline or a roadmap as to how that's coming and when that'll be done?
I mean, we have a timeline, but with no ETAs, as it's open source.
Do you have a community meeting that people can join and hear about the latest?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a bi-weekly meeting online on Tuesdays, and we keep discussing what's the further steps.
And what are you looking for a lot from the community right now? Are you looking for people to use it, come up with new use cases?
Absolutely.
Or contributions?
Yeah. So our logging operator was very successful. We got a lot of new use cases. That's why we started the new multi-tenant capabilities telemetry controller. And I hope that people will start to use it, get feedbacks, and we improve it, because I think it will be a very cool project. I mean, my goal is like with what you do with JSTAC Cert Manager. If you need certificates, you just install that. If you want to handle logging, monitoring, you will install Telemetry Controller.
Super cool. Are you on the CNCF Slack? Is that
yeah.
Can we find you there? Okay, great. This is super cool. I'm going to check it out when we get back. Appreciate the time and looking forward to tracking this project. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to meet you.
All right. So I'm here with Andrea from Kubeflow. Tell us about Kubeflow.
Sure. Thank you for having me. I'm Andrea. I am with Canonical, and I'm here to talk about Kubeflow. When it comes to Kubeflow, it's an open source project, part of CNCF. That's why we are at KubeCon, indeed.
True.
It's an incubation project.
It's incubation.
These days.
Okay.
It's a project that has been on the market for around 6 years, actually. It's a data science and ML platform, or an MLOps platform for those who are more advanced. It's a suite of tools, open source tools, that aim to enable ML engineers, data scientists, to develop, optimize, and deploy models. It has leading open source components. Kubeflow notebooks are very similar to Jupyter notebooks that people are very familiar with. You have KTi for model optimization or hyperparameter tuning. You have Kser for model inference and Knative, for example, as well.
Okay.
It's a cloud native application. It's important to mention that runs on Kubernetes.
So what is Kubeflow exactly? Like from a tech, is it a, so it's a project And it helps it so I can load all these different modules in. Or
it's a platform.
It's a platform.
Once you deploy to get access to all these tools that I just mentioned.
Okay, so it's kind of like packaging ML tools.
Yes.
And then it takes care of like the CRDs or the operators or the daemon sets. Okay. So really, it's just kind of best practice for ML
yes.
tools.
And one important thing that we don't mention, it's designed to automate ML workloads. Because if you think of how to run models in production, you need to build pipelines to automate your workloads. And that's why Kubeflow really was innovative 5 years ago. Nowadays, a lot of companies and other projects use it.
Right. Okay. And so I'm curious, GPU-wise, does it do some cool stuff to enable GPU, stuff like that?
Yes. I mean, when you look at the compute resources in general, they're very much related to Kubernetes. You need to have the GPU operator, you can have schedulers and so on. But then also Kubeflow itself integrates, for example, with PaddlePaddle for distributed training to optimize the resources underneath. You have user management capabilities, profiles, to ensure that the resources are split depending on how the administrator of the platform wants.
Yeah.
And it's suitable for larger data science or ML teams.
Okay. So can you tell me about some cool use cases that you know about? Of people using Kubeflow?
Yes. Now I'm biased because I know stories from our customers,
sure.
from Canonical. For example, we have one retailer in the US, it's one of the biggest ones, and they use Kubeflow to build all their system recommenders. On one hand, for the e-commerce part, for the online store, but then they also build promotion analysis and almost like system recommenders for the in-person stores, for the brick and mortar stores.
Are they doing it on the edge or do they do that?
No, so they do initially the training on-prem, having Kubeflow deployed on a Kubernetes distribution that we can find around here.
So they have it on a cloud somewhere or yeah. in a data center.
Yeah.
So they use it for training.
And for inference as well, because then they deploy the model using Kserve on smaller edges closer to the store itself.
So, and the Kubeflow piece of that puzzle, is it made it very easy for them to deploy the model, but also for the training. So are they using...
It's an end-to-end solution for the whole ML lifecycle.
Okay, so it's an end-to-end solution.
It's like, if we oversimplify it, that's what it is. Another cool use case is in the public sector, where I live, in one of the leading organizations. They build an AI sovereign cloud, and they use Kubeflow on top of it to build all their use cases to identify any accident in the city, to optimize the streetlights colors, to do traffic decongestion based on models that are trained on Kubeflow and then they're deployed with Kserve, which is part of Kubeflow.
And so the real thing here is you can use Kubeflow to install. So what do you know what tools in particular one of those examples are using that they use?
So they Kubeflow? Use all of them use Kubeflow notebooks for training models.
So Kubeflow notebooks.
And then they use Kubeflow pipelines to automate the workloads. You have it's quite nice because the pipelines themselves are, you can split them into steps. You can schedule them. You can trigger them when the data changes. You can.
So I can use any like pandas or TensorFlow.
Yeah, but you can use
or
those.
PyTorch
yeah.
or whatever.
Those ones you use them in the notebooks. And then they use Katib for hyperparameter tuning.
Sorry, which one?
Katib.
Katib, okay.
For hyperparameter tuning, optimizing the model, because just building a model is not enough.
Right.
You need to get better performance.
And so Kubeflow makes it super easy to install that tooling. And there's some very opinionated cube notebook stuff. Okay, cool. I'm going to check it out. So you said you're incubating right now. What's the next step for the project?
Graduation.
Yeah, of course. Do you have a timeline on that? Have you done the security stuff yet or...
It is interesting. We've been working on it, and it's important to mention that we really welcome contributors as well as users to share their feedback with us. We have a security working group. We have scanners enabled on all the working on all the components, and we are advancing on the security side as well. It's one of the priorities that we're having, and then some of the official distributions are really helping out on that front. And then I think that timeline, it really depends on how we advance with a couple of things. We have the steering committee in place. We are moved towards the CNCF channels. The security part is on track.
So if I want to find you and I want to help contribute on anything.
Kubeflow.org or go on Slack and look for the Kubeflow channel and you're going to find
that. Okay, so
there.
In the CNCF Slack, you guys are in there. And last question, do you guys have meetings? Monthly, yes. weekly?
Yes, so we have thanks for asking this. We have the weekly community call. It's every Tuesday. I will not say the time because it really depends.
Time zones are a pain.
Yes.
Believe me.
For those who are in Europe, It's somewhere in the afternoon.
It's somewhere in the afternoon for those in Europe. Okay.
So it's America friendly.
But it's every Tuesday, you said?
Yes, that's okay. A community call. And then each working group has their own calls because some people are more passionate about notebooks. Some people are more passionate about training operator. So you can always join that. But I think the very good starting point is the Kubeflow community call. Go on kubeflow.org, get familiar with the project, maybe try it out. And
right. And find you and everybody in the CNCF Slack for Kubeflow. Okay, great. Well, thanks for talking, Andrea. What's your, Andrea? Oh my God.
Montano.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Andrea. All right. Sitting here with Terrence and Jesse from buildpacks.io. Terrence Lee and Jesse, what's your last name?
Brown.
Jesse Brown. And we're going to talk a little bit about buildpacks. Terrence, give us a quick 30 second. What is buildpacks.io?
Buildpacks. Simply take your application source code, transforms it into an OCI container image without the need of Docker files. And what you get is a well-constructed image with layers that map logically to your application.
So, okay. So is this related to the, I remember buildpacks from the Pivotal days and Is that related to that or is it a different project?
It is an evolution of kind of the early kind of Heroku and Pivotal efforts from there. And so we were actually kind of two separate companies that we're doing buildpack things, and then we kind of came together and we're like, we want a unified ecosystem and we want to not produce proprietary artifacts and kind of produce stuff in this container ecosystem. But
Heroku is the company behind buildpacks right now, though, like the ones that created the buildpacks.
Yeah, the originals of kind of the buildpack stuff from the way back in the day.
Okay, so are you guys a sandbox project?
We're an incubation project. We're an
incubation.
We joined a sandbox, I want to say in like 2018, okay. But we got incubation in 2020.
Okay, so your incubation. What's next on the map for buildpacks?
We're looking at graduation. We actually just finished our security audit this summer, I want to say. And then I guess like KubeCon snuck up and we kind of just never got around to finishing up the rest of the graduation stuff.
I want to talk more about buildpacks in a second, but I think it would be really interesting. Can you tell us about what that security audit was like? Like, what did you have to do? So you got to incubation and then the next step is the security audit. Just tell us a little bit about that process and what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, the CNCF is great. You kind of reach out to them and they hook you up with a third party company that we work with OSTIF. And basically they go through, you point them at kind of all your repos and things. And they like find a company that's like specialized for like what you have and what you're looking for. And basically they go through and review all your stuff and you kind of do a bunch of back and forth of like, they find some things, you talk through some stuff, and then you kind of like get to a point where you agree on what the problems are and kind of what the fixes are. And they give you, you know, like some amount of time before they post it publicly.
Cool. And so how long did that take? How long does that process take?
I would say that probably took us 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
To kind of go through that.
And you felt it was really good. It like helps the project.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, like, it's really nice to have someone else, like a third-party person, like actually validate that what you're doing is secure or not secure, and like someone who actually specializes in that.
All right, so let's go back to buildpacks for a second. Does it generate a Docker file, or what does it do? What is the? It generates an OCI image.
Yes.
Does it generate a file, a Docker file?
We don't use Docker files at all, so there's no Docker file that's created as part of that. So one of the benefits from that, from our perspective, we're not also kind of constrained to how Docker file does caching and other things. So buildpacks execute, and then we have an exporter that basically takes the file system that's on disk and converts it into an OCI image at the end with metadata and things like that.
So it sounds great. I don't have to go build a bunch of scripts. I don't have to write Docker files. I don't have to do this. And you said it creates an optimal OCI image with like has the right layers and stuff. How does it do it? Like, how technical can you actually get in like a quick 5-minute interview right here? Can you explain it?
Yeah, basically like buildpacks can be written in any language that basically runs in what I would say is like the build image that you're going to execute the buildpacks in, that you're going to build on top of. And usually buildpacks are gonna encapsulate a certain technology like a Java, Ruby, Node, Python, HV, et cetera, right? And what the buildpack gets to do is they get tight control over what gets put in, what layers you wanna create. So like the kind of a subject matter expert for that particular technology or ecosystem can decide like, okay, like let's say I wanna do Node. I'm gonna put in the Node runtime. I'll probably read that from your package.json no engine thing because that's like the standard in that ecosystem, right? I'm going to run either npm yarn, et cetera, to install the node modules. And then the nice thing is like you get an OCI image at the end. Dark files are pretty similar. You can get something like that, right? The big benefit then is like the buildpack author has the ability to do advanced caching. And so they get to decide when to bust the cache. It's not decided just on file system changes. So that means like, let's say I add a single node module to my package.json. I'm going to keep my entire cache. I'm not going to toss it. There's no reason to. I'm just adding a node module to my node modules, right? I'll run npm install, adds it, like local development. Let's say I upgrade my version node. Now, the ABI version has changed. It now makes sense to blow that entire cache away. And so the build pack has the flexibility to do that because we aren't like constrained with how Dockerfile does cache.
So to be clear, build packs is the project, but each language kind of has its own plugin for, is that the right?
A build pack.
A build pack, okay.
Yeah.
So it has its own build pack. So if I wanted to do a Fortran build pack, which I don't think is a great idea, but if I want to do a Fortran build pack, I could contribute that and go to buildpacks.io, I could contribute the Fortran one. Now, what about me as an end user that has a node project? I would never have a node project. I'm a four of a Go Python guy, but imagine I have this Python project and I want to tweak something. I don't want to use exactly what the build pack is for Python. I want to bust Poetry's cache for some reason or whatever. Is there a capability to do that? Or how do I customize these images that are generated as the end user, not the author of the build pack, but as the person using the build pack?
Sure. You have a few options. Like at the end of the day, if you build a image with the build pack, it is an OCI image. So you could, at the end of the day, if you know how to do Dockerfiles and things, you could just inherit with a from that image and like edit it that way using tools you know. You could add, like build your own build pack that runs like after the existing one.
So like fork the Python build pack.
You either fork it or like just add another build pack that you wrote. You can chain them together.
Oh, you can chain. Okay, that's cool.
There's also like inline build packs. So like if you don't want to like full blown write your own build pack, you could use the inline build pack through a project descriptor to like have that one-off thing in after like the Python build pack has executed.
All right. Well, if I want to participate in the community, check you guys out, where do I go to participate?
On GitHub, we're in the buildpacks.org with an S at the end, plural. And then we're in the CNCF Slack in the buildpacks channel as well. Super simple.
Do you guys have a community meeting weekly? Yep.
We have weekly meetings on Thursdays. If you go to buildpacks.io/community, you can see kind of the times for that.
Super cool. And you're on the Slack? You're on the CNCF Slack?
Yep.
Okay, great. Buildpacks is the channel. All right, wonderful. Thank you so much, Terrence Lee and Jesse Brown. We'll look forward to seeing how this project graduates.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. So I'm here with the Kairos folks.
Yep.
Mauro. Tell us about Kairos. First off, how do you spell it? And how do you say it? And then tell us a little bit about what it is.
So English is not my mother tongue. So sorry for any mistake, but it's K-A-I-R-O-S, Kairos. That's how we pronounce it. We have a Greek person in the team, so it turns out it's not the proper way to pronounce it in Greek, but who cares, right? And the project comes out of the necessity of moving outside of the cloud into the edge space. The idea is that in a data center, there are many problems that you don't have that you do have at the edge. For example, security is a lot more problematic at the edge. If you are running a system, let's say in a gas station or, I don't know, in a grocery store, it is a lot more exposed to people to come and try to mess with the device or to steal the data, of course.
Right, there's much more physical access to the edge.
That's correct. So that drives most of the decisions of the operating system in this case. And some of those features are, for example, systems are completely immutable with the idea that nobody can come and try to install a new package or a rootkit, for example.
Yeah, so wait, so backing up a second. So Kairos is a Linux distro, is that correct?
It's, we sell it as a meta distribution because Kairos is distro agnostic. We want to play well with as many distributions as possible. So as long as it has either systemd or OpenRC as their in its system, then it can run Kairos. That means Alpine, Ubuntu, OpenSUSE, all of them run Kairos. We call them Kairos flavors.
Okay, so there's these Kairos flavors and Kairos basically locks down the OS, essentially. give me five highlights of how it locks down the OS real quick.
Yeah, so we have immutability, for example, which means that you have less snowflakes than you would normally have. Like you can have with other configuration management systems, despite the idea that you are creating a fleet, it's still possible to log into the system and change something. With Kairos, that's not an option because it's immutable.
So fully immutable. Okay. Yeah. What is the second best thing?
Yeah, it's, for example, we have AB upgrades. That means that instead of doing an upgrade that could end up in a mixed state, you don't have that. Either you upgrade or you don't upgrade. And if for some reason you're not able to upgrade, then it rolls back automatically to our passive image. So
that's really kind of like the embedded model for OSs, where there's like basically two memory banks.
Yeah.
Very limited, and if it doesn't work, it just flips back over.
That's correct.
Okay, tell me the third best thing about Kairos.
In terms of security, we have a feature called Trusted Boot, which means that once you have decided which operating system is going to be booted in your machine, no other operating system can be booted there. This is done using TPM chips, so it's hardware measurements. It cannot be changed. If someone wants to run another operating system, has to be signed with your keys.
Wow, okay, that's super cool. So what is like the typical install? Like, is it a Raspberry Pi? It's not gonna be an ESP32, that doesn't have enough juice.
Yeah.
But what's a few of the cool target pieces of hardware that you've seen Kairos on so far?
We have a bit of everything, if I can be honest. The Home Labber definitely targets the Raspberry Pi, for example. But we have a video of everything. It runs on, for example, there are cases of drones picking up fruit that have Kairos underneath. There are cases where it's used for teaching networking at schools. There are cases where it's in a, you know, traditional NUC, simple system, nothing too expensive, where you can stack three of those and create a Kubernetes cluster, something like this.
Cool. Is it sandbox? It's in the CNCF.
That's correct. It's part of the CNCF. We are a sandbox project. We were just admitted in April. And
so April 2024, you got admitted. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What is the next phase for Kairos? What are the things that you're working on in the next 6 months that are the priorities?
Yeah, the main two priorities at the moment are CAPI, so a cluster API, so that you can manage an entire fleet through Kubernetes. And the other one is remote attestation, so that the same level of security that I was explaining before with the TPM chips, but also that remotely, for some reason, you might say, okay, that node has been stolen or whatever, that you can make sure that it never calls home, that it shuts down as properly as you can trust it to do.
Right. Okay. So is that kind of like an MDM vibe kind of thing, if you're familiar with?
Good question. I'm not familiar with it.
That's the, what it, luckily I'm here with Mark. Mark, what does MDM stand for? It's the...
It's like device management.
So it's like device management for Kairos. Is that kind of a way to...
We don't have that part that... That's on your side, yeah.
When you say attestation, that's kind of what you mean by that, or...
Attestation for us is we want you to be sure that there is no other OS spinning up in the machine than the one that you have designated to run. For two reasons. One, this means that you will not have snowflakes. And two, it means that if someone tries to put a rootkit or anything like that, they simply can't and they cannot access your encrypted data.
Super cool. So if I wanted to be a part of Kairos, contribute to Kairos, where's the best place to find you guys? When do you have your community meetings? How do I find you?
Yeah, so since we're part of the CNCF, you can find us in the Slack server under the Kairos channel. We also have a website called kairos.io. There is all the information that you might need. And on GitHub, we are kairos-io.
Cool. Are there any community meetings or anything like that?
Yes, every Monday, 5:30, if I'm not mistaken, Central European time. You can find us there.
I have no idea what that time is anywhere else, but 5 Central European time is great. Thank you so much for your time, Mauro.
Thank you, guys. Happy to be here.
Okay, so on the last day at KubeCon, my voice is not doing amazing, but luckily we have Paige Patton from Red Hat, and she's going to talk to us about Kraken.
Kraken, yes.
Spelled K-R-K-N.
Yes, no vowels.
No vowels. Paige, what is Kraken?
So Kraken is a chaos and resiliency tool. It's pretty new to the CNCF area. It's a sandbox project. Pretty much what our goal is to inject chaos, test resiliency, test different performance metrics on a cluster of any sort. It runs completely outside the cluster, so you don't have to install anything on the cluster so that the cluster goes down in a pretty high chaotic scenario, that things will come back. We can still get our logs. We can see what happened. And then at the end of the chaos, we can attach to Prometheus and do a bunch of different SLOs, different calls to see what our metrics were, if our latency came back, if it's too slow now, and then be able to attach to different services, or you can do disk-based Kubernetes testing.
Super cool. Okay, so where does Kraken run then? Do I install it in a separate cluster, or is it just an agent that runs?
Yeah, just an agent. So you can clone the project, run in Python, or we have a kind of newer binary that you can download and just run Kraken CTL and just run from command line using PodVamp.
Kraken Cuddle.
Cuddle.
I prefer.
Yes.
Cuddle. And so what it does is it just looks at like, oh, here's a CRD. I'm going to corrupt it.
Yes.
Here's a pod. I'm going to.
Yes. And so we have all different sorts of different scenarios. We have pod, we have network, we have completely taking down a node based on your specific cloud provider. You can connect to AWS, GCP, all of those based on their Python cloud providers.
Okay, so it would actually take down a node, for example. So it would integrate. So I'd give it like some permissions to a particular cluster. It would actually go into my cloud provider and then turn off the node.
Exactly.
So it's not faking it. It's nope. Actually, okay.
Yeah, but you can go into the whole cloud provider, see that the node is completely stopped, if that's your scenario, and then restart it after a certain amount of time, see if your components came back or if anything slowed down, stuff like that.
Oh, that's super cool. And so for the pod shutting down or a sidecar thing, so you guys, it sounds like you guys have scenarios that you, and then I assume there's like a, not a marketplace, but people contribute other scenarios?
Yes, definitely. We're kind of a newer project as we're just sandbox, but we're hoping for new scenarios, new use cases, people being able to know applications, be able to apply all of those things.
Super cool. So, okay, so you're sandboxed.
Yep.
When did this project start?
We started, I want to say maybe 5 years ago.
Okay.
I started at Red Hat about 5 years ago, and I kind of just got into it from the get-go there. It's really grown. We all used to only have pod scenarios, and now we have, I think, 15 scenarios of different components. So it's really grown, but it's all from our minds of
right.
What scenarios we have. So trying to get other industry, chaotic community support is really what we're looking for as well.
Okay, super cool. So if I want to find you
yeah.
and contribute or help, where do I find you guys?
We are on GitHub, and we also had a website, which is probably our main place, which is kraken-chaos.dev.
That does not have vowels either.
It does not have vowels.
So we'll spell it real quick. kraken-chaos.dev.
Yes.
Okay. Now, are you on the CNCF Slack as well?
I'm not sure if we're on the CNCF Slack, but we're on Kubernetes Slack.
You're in the Kubernetes Slack.
Yeah,
okay.
Same K-R-K-N.
Yeah. Okay, great. And then also, do you have community meetings?
We don't have community meetings yet. We're trying to get kind of an overall chaos community with meetings setting up, but that's still in the future. I think some other tools were in a community at some point, it's kind of died off. So we're hoping to bring it back.
Okay, so the best place to contribute and to see what's going on is GitHub.
Yep.
And then also the website, and yeah. There's some contact information.
Yes, and like GitHub is linked in the website. So the website is really kind of a catch-all that you can get to everything.
Perfect. Thanks, Paige. Great to check out Kraken. It's exciting. I'm going to check it out.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right, we're sitting here with Avi Press from Scarf. Great name, I got to say. Tell us what Scarf is, Avi.
Scarf is a platform for usage analytics for open source software. And we provide sales and marketing intelligence to companies that commercialize open source.
All right, so give me an example of what does that look like? How does that help?
Yeah, so let's take projects in the CNCF where, say you have set of Docker containers that get downloaded from whatever registry you publish it to. We build a container registry gateway. You can think of it like a link shortener that you can Docker pull through it. You can pip install through it. You can curl a binary through it, et cetera. So we're kind of like a middle layer between the end user and the artifact registry. We analyze all the traffic that comes through and generate insights about how your open source is being used.
So you're kind of like a Bitly for for my container registry, for example. Is it mostly for Docker containers, or is it also for repos and
anything?
So if I'm doing a Git clone, I would do Git clone, then the scarf. What's scarf.io? What is
scarf.sh?
I'm doing scarf.sh/ Linux.
Right, right. And we let you pick your own domain. You can CNAME a custom domain to us. So it's whatever domain you want. But that's just one way we collect data. We also make cookieless tracking pixels that can go in open source documentation, your website, et cetera. And then we also just support regular old telemetry if you want to send us events from your code. And so the idea is from users discovering the project to downloading it and trying it out to using it, deploying it, et cetera, we're giving a way to collect all that data in a privacy conscious way and then get useful insights out of it.
Interesting. So this is for open source projects?
Yes, it's for open source projects.
So just to be a little commercial about it, so you're kind of like a top of funnel for like, if I'm an open source project and I have a paid, have partially paid model, and I know this one company or person is using this project a lot, that whole life cycle, then I know, hey, I want to reach out to that person. Now, you said you're privacy focused. How do I reach out to that person if I don't know who that person is?
Right. So, yeah. So Scarf is GDPR compliant by default. So we're not going to keep an IP address that we collect. We will enrich it with all the metadata that we can collect about whatever, you know, anonymous traffic that we are seeing. But from there, we can start to do lead generation based on like who your ideal customer profile is, where the traffic is coming from, what they're doing, what we score that lead, et cetera. And basically give teams a platform that can operationalize that data. Their marketing teams can focus on, you know, the top of the funnel, you know, who's kind of interested. You know, sales might be nurturing the production deployments, whatever way is most appropriate for that project and company.
So a lot of projects, and I'm guessing Scarf is the same way, there's a lot of open source components and there's a lot of proprietary hosted closed source components. What part of it is open source?
Yeah, so for Scarf, our gateway, the thing that sits in front and, you know, proxies or redirects that traffic, that whole thing is open source. Our SDKs are open source. The analytics pipeline is the thing that we keep proprietary. Yeah, our gateway is, it's a very novel thing. It can kind of redirect arbitrary traffic. You can almost think of it like just a really flexible reverse proxy, but it can also redirect, and then you get all the great analytics out of it.
So I could like run that, just the open source component, and it would be able to capture the traffic that was going through that gateway locally on that machine. It wouldn't have access to the full Scarf analytics and everything.
Right. Like you'd be able to do all the redirection and you'd be able to like switch registries on a dime and do all that stuff, but you wouldn't have all of our like intelligent analytics behind it, basically.
Right. But I could like print logs and...
Yeah, exactly. And we hope you do.
Okay, super cool. I do think it's actually important for the open source world to figure out how to monetize responsibly.
Yeah.
That is what this is all built on. So it sounds like that's kind of what you guys are after. How far along is Scarf? How far along are you as a company?
Yeah, so we've been at this for about 5 years now. We're about a 15-person team. We work with about 500 open source organizations. We work with the Linux Foundation, the Apache Software Foundation, CNCF. So, you know, we're still a small startup, but we've come a long way. We have most of the Fortune 500 downloading artifacts from us every month.
And then the last piece, my obvious question, I think I know the answer, but as an open source project,
yeah,
I need to seek out Scarf and use the SDKs, give the links to the proxy stuff. So with Scarf though, the open source projects have to implement some component of Scarf. You're not like mirroring a bunch of stuff and we just use the Scarf version of it, or?
That is correct. The answer here is, I guess, a little bit nuanced. So yeah, if you wanna collect data specifically about your project, you'd have to instrument some kind of tracking of this. However, increasingly, Scarf is collecting so much data from so many different projects, we are able to provide kind of useful, really high-level aggregated reports that we do, you know, that we also do work with some companies on. But yeah, if you want data about your project in particular, you do have to set up some kind of tracking.
Okay, so if I'm an open source project, how do I use you? What do I do?
So what you do, you'd sign up for a Scarf account, you'd make an organization on our site, you would create any one of a couple different things. You'd basically make like a what we call a package entry. So, you know, you may have some package that you publish, you're going to make a corresponding entry in Scarf. You tell us where the artifacts are, and we spin up a endpoint that people can pull down those artifacts from. You update your docs.
Sure. And you put the pixel in.
You put the pixel in the doc.
Okay, so it's pretty straightforward, pretty minimal.
Yeah.
For our listeners that want to instrument their open source project, seems pretty simple. And there's a cost, I'm guessing.
So it's entirely free to use. Scarf charges for the company. If you want to see the commercial data, which companies are using this, that's where we charge.
Okay, great.
But if you are a CNCF project, there's no seat license at all. So we, for our partnership with the Linux Foundation, free to use for any LF CNCF project. Your whole group of all the maintainers can get in entirely for free. You get unlimited data retention for free as well.
All right, that's super cool. Well, really appreciate sitting down with us, Avi. And yeah, that's cool. And I like to help our listeners figure out how to monetize and track. Cool. Thanks, Avi.
That's all we have time for today. If you're interested in being a guest on this show, or if you would like to suggest a topic, head over to kubelist.com. I'm Mark Campbell, CTO at Replicated, where we enable cloud-native software vendors to operationalize and scale the distribution of their modern on-prem applications to their largest enterprise customers. Check us out at replicated.com. My co-host is Benji DeGroot, CEO at Shipyard, where they enable isolated ephemeral environments on every code change for companies of all sizes. Check them out at shipyard.build. This show is brought to you by HeavyBit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. For more information, visit heavybit.com. And finally, don't forget to sign up for the Kubelist weekly newsletter and read previous issues at kubelist.com.